Here's a question for this morning. In what election campaign was the central issue identified by the slogan, "If you think education is expensive, try ignorance"? As I prepare this week's World Report, it's Sunday, and like most people in British Columbia, I'm waiting to hear whether or not the teachers will go back to work Monday morning. From an international perspective, there's more to this issue than has been reported in the news. At the very least, some dots that haven't been connected. BC isn't the only place to have problems with its educational system. For many years, in the world's impoverished countries, the World Bank, working with the IMF, aggressively promoted reduced government spending in an effort to decrease budget deficits, keep inflation low, and raise overall economic growth rates. Central governments were pressed to give local governments the responsibility to deliver basic services such as health care and education. As part of this reform, local governments were then forced to raise revenues through new charges on basic services. This was called decentralization and cost sharing, but were really user fees. In many cases, these fees were strongly promoted, sometimes even required by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, as a condition for new loans and debt relief. But it wasn't working. In 1996, as part of his election campaign, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni abolished school fees for 4 children per family. Then in 1997, 2.3 million additional children showed up for class, nearly doubling enrollment to 5.7 million, nearly a 50% increase. In Kenya, the new government and voters understood that abolishing school fees would be costly in financial terms, but the Free Education Campaign slogan said it all. If you think education is expensive, try ignorance. When Mwai Kibaki was elected president of Kenya in December 2002, he probably got more press for distributing 500,000 free condoms. But the central promise of the election campaign was the abolition of all fees for primary school. No sooner was Kibaki elected than the promise was fulfilled. When school reconvened in January, 1.2 million new children poured into the educational system within 1 week, an increase of over 20%. The numbers eventually rose to 1.7 million. Stephen Lewis, the UN envoy to Africa for HIV/AIDS, recounts that, quote, "In one instance in an urban slum community many miles from Nairobi, the population of the primary school after the fee announcement jumped from 1,000 to 5,000 students. But when the headmistress insisted that every child must come to school in a uniform, the numbers dropped to 2,600, a major revelation in itself. The Ministry of Education asserted that absolutely nothing, including uniforms, was to stand in the way of school attendance, and the numbers moved back up. 6 months after the election, Lewis reflected, quote, "The implications are stunning. 1,200,000 children who had not been in school turned up for school. Kenya has an estimated 1,200,000 children orphaned by AIDS. Are they identical cohorts? Of course not. Is there a significant overlap? Everyone agrees that the overlap is large. What, then, is the situation on the rest of the continent for millions of other children orphaned by AIDS, particularly in the high-prevalence countries? How is it possible that a campaign to eliminate school fees has not been launched across Africa? Where is the leadership to come from? Why should such vast numbers of children who have lost one or both parents to AIDS, who have little, if anything, to eat, who have no guarantee of shelter, no guarantee of health or nutritional care, no guarantee of a home or of love or of nurture, why on top of it all should they be denied the right to go to school and the prospect of a future simply because they're impoverished?" End quote. That was Stephen Lewis commenting on Kenya's elimination of school fees in 2003. In fact, Tanzania, Malawi, Lesotho, and Mozambique followed Uganda's lead. In 2002, the U.S. Congress lobbied by advocacy groups for the poor, adopted legislation requiring that the United States oppose World Bank loans conditioned on user fees in education. In 2002, the World Bank, already supporting several free education initiatives, officially reversed its policy, deciding to oppose all such fees. But the change has not been easy or complete. Just last month, Save the Children UK published research showing that 13 sub-Saharan African countries still charge tuition fees. Of the 20 countries in sub-Saharan Africa with the highest proportion of girls out of school, at least 8 charge tuition fees for primary education. In many more countries, parents have to pay charges for textbooks, uniforms, and transport. Neoliberalism is an economic philosophy that led to the misguided policy of user fees in the first place. Neoliberal globalization, as it was enforced by the World Bank and IMF through their structural adjustment programs, usually employed a sixfold prescriptive framework. First, to reduce government spending, size, and scope. Second, to produce goods primarily for export rather than for either self-sufficiency or diversification. Third, to liberalize the resultant international trade by reducing taxes and eliminating tariffs and foreign investment controls, called liberalizing the capital account, rather than managing supply or protecting jobs, prices, and communities. Fourth, to privatize basic common public goods such as land, clean water, environmental quality, space, health, justice, daycare, education, energy, and infrastructure. Fifth, to eliminate the government's function as a regulator, to deregulate. And sixth, to attack those who organize for wages, working conditions, and job security. Weak labor laws, referred to as flexibility, and cheap labor are magnets for foreign investment. The explosion in enrollments put enormous pressure on an overburdened, often poorly managed education system. Near the end of a school year that runs from January to November, Rebecca Mwanyonyo, an earnest wisp of a woman teaching grade 1 in Malindi, Kenya, is still struggling to teach most of her students the alphabet and basic counting. She knows the names of only half. She estimates that 100 of her 250 students, split into morning and afternoon shifts, will have to repeat the grade. Squeezed together on the concrete floor, they sit hip to hip, jostling for space, wildly waving their hands to get her to call on them. Their laps and the floor are their only desks. One of her students, Salama Kuzungu, a girl of 12, failed last year in the class of another first grade teacher who had 248 pupils. "If I could have, I would have run away," the teacher confided, relieved he has just 110 pupils this year. When education costs rise, the girls are the first to be withdrawn from schools. But Salama already had her fill of the African woman's lot, fetching water, collecting firewood, and carrying it to market on her back like a beast of burden. "I was always working and working," she said. "I told myself that the best way to get out of this is to come to school and get an education." Farther south, Malawi's decade-old, underfunded and largely unplanned experiment is generally regarded as a disaster. The number of children in a first-grade class averages 100. 4 out of 10 of first graders repeat the year. Children's achievement scores are among the lowest in Africa. Uganda, often held up as a model, also found that achievement fell as classes swelled with highly disadvantaged students. But in the past 8 years, donors have invested more than $350 million, and the government also increased spending. Test results from last year show that achievement bounced back, though more than half of third graders still perform poorly in math and English. What hangs in the balance is the future of a generation of African children desperately reaching out for learning as a lifeline from poverty, even as poverty itself presents a fearsome obstacle. Even those immersed in the basic issues of achieving universal primary education acknowledge the challenge. You can get the kids into school, says Pod Murphy, who recently retired as one of the World Bank's leading education specialists. But keeping them there and making them learn involves a whole lot more than we've understood. To be sure, British Columbia is not Africa, and the teachers' strike was not about school fees, but it was about how to implement the mysteries of education, and anyone who has lived in BC for longer than a few months will recognize in the neoliberal list a familiar cluster of policies. Indeed, all across Canada, the call for smaller government numbers has drowned out the call for better quality. Now we have enormous budget surpluses to be spent by governments that have already eviscerated services like education and health, so that the frontline workers scarcely have the energy to put on a show of doing their jobs. After decades of neoliberal belt tightening, going all the way back to Bill Bennett, the schools of our province, like the schools of Uganda, Kenya, Mozambique, indeed like most schools around the world, need a champion, not shock therapy. That's it for this Monday. This feature draws on material from the New York Times, a press conference with Stephen Lewis, 50 Years is Enough, Global Exchange, and Save the Children UK. If you'd like to suggest a story or comment about anything you hear on Monday Morning World Report, email Earthling, that's EARTHLING, at netidea.com. Put Monday Morning World Report in the subject line to make sure I don't mistake your message for spam. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.